Welcome back to the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are really tickled to have Humasa Kela with us. Let's go back a little bit. South Africa, for me, was the theme that ran through everything that you wanted. Well, I don't know if it's what you wanted me to know, but certainly everything I was revisiting, thinking about as I read, still grazing. When you go back and really look at your whole life, South Africa, you can't get away from South Africa as Humasa Kela tells his story. Do you feel that as you went through all that? Were you always carrying the motherland with you?
Yeah, well, the thing is that it was difficult to get away from South Africa because it was like my very source. My grandmother said to me when I left, when I was 21 years old, she said, we don't care if you become successful. You don't have to send money, but just write your mother once a month. You know. But she also reminded me that when you were born, you didn't have a place to stay. You didn't bring any clothes with you. You didn't have any money, and we took you in. If your instincts were not to be here, you would have self-destructed then, but you wanted to stay with us. And like, we put you up for 17 years for free and clothed you and everything. And it took us 3 years just to show you where the toilet was. You know?
Your grandmother who lived to 104.
Right. And whatever you do, just remember that you didn't bring anything on this earth and that you got it in this house where you're born and from the people from whom you source everything that you want to be. And I grew up in a country when I was born, we had had 350 years of war already. So it was a country where I want to call my next book, there's no love songs in South Africa yet, you know, because all the songs were about the past. They are about eventually winning. They are about our, and that's part of the reason that we lost the country is because when we were fighting our enemies through the centuries, we'd sing first, and they always would know where we are. Sang beautifully, so like whether it was the British or the Dutch, said, "Let's listen for a while. This is beautiful music, but at least we know where they are because we'd be singing." And music is in the fabric of our whole struggle, and it brings us right up to like the liberation struggle, and it is like the real foundation on which like our struggle stand has always been music. And it affected the world so much and infected it that they joined us, because our 10th anniversary this year is being celebrated by the whole world, and I've never heard of any country that had that kind of fortune, because our struggle was fought by the whole world. So wherever I was, there were people who were pushing like the South African liberation, whether I wasn't thinking about it or not that day. So I eventually vicariously lived in South Africa, although I was here. So my spirit was always there, and my body was outside.
But you couldn't go back. Didn't that affect you too? Didn't the inability to go home have a draw on you?
I think it had a major negative effect. It might have been subconscious, but the thing is that because I wasn't home, because I didn't have that support system that I might have needed, especially when I got successful, I wasn't grounded enough, and people were called, you know, come. Because at that time, like, people come out of the network, out of the woodwork, out of the walls, you know, to say, "I'm your friend, do it this way, do it that way." And if my grandmother was nearby, or like I could go home, you know,
she would have beaten them up.
Yeah, she would have said, "Don't you remember what I told you?" You know. But I think that it was very difficult. You know, in 1965, there was a man called Ned Nakasa, was one of our greatest writers in South Africa. He came overseas as a Nieman scholarship, a Fulbright scholar. And in South Africa, he even started a magazine, a book himself. He was the first African to do that. And he was a very good friend of Nadine Gordimer's. But when he came overseas, it was the time of Malcolm X and the civil rights. And like, nobody was impressed with him, although he had been a literary star in South Africa. And he met Malcolm X in Tanzania, and Malcolm X just told him that, well, that is not where you should be, your head should be. So by the time he arrived in New York, he felt that he was a failure, that he had been doing all the wrong things, that he'd been hanging around with liberal people, he hadn't been militant enough, and we tried to convince him, you know. And then the articles that he started to write to send to like different magazines here, people were not impressed with what he was writing. You know, they said, "It's a struggle. Why are you writing this light stuff?" And he became very disillusioned with himself. Well, to cut to the chase, he jumped out of the window and lost his life. And at his funeral, at that time, there must have been about 100 or so students, you know, and I was married to Miriam McGowan, and we buried him. But at his funeral by the graveside with all the people who knew him and people who knew us, we cried so much, but we didn't cry so much for Nat as we were crying out of fear that we might die overseas ourselves. And every time somebody died from, whether it was in Tanzania, in the camps or wherever, it seemed so much sadder than when people pass away at home, because they have the whole support system, you know. And I think in the back of your mind is that fear that I'm so far away from home, you know. And then the other things are like, all of a sudden you have to fend for yourself, you have to do your own washing, your own cooking, you know. And when you're broke, you're broke. You can't go to your uncle or your aunt or your, you know. And all those things sort of like, I think, make you lose your balance, and you live in a kind of little fear, and as a result, you sort of hang on to South Africa all the time. So I got to a point by the 70s where I was monitoring South Africa on almost an hourly basis, what's going on. So in the hope that if I ever got back, it wouldn't seem like I was away. But lo and behold, when I finally went back, I tried to be with it. And people were like, "Oh, no, we don't talk like that anymore. We don't do that."
That was 30, you were 30 years ago.
30 years out of sync.
You point out correctly that Americans can be just amazingly parochial and not know much about the world at all.
Parochial is the nice thing to say about all we don't know about the world.
But there were two things that really jumped out at me in the book. One is just the sheer musicality of the environment you came out of, and how and what that made possible when you came to New York. And the other was just the incredible violence of apartheid. Mm. Mm. And both of those things, you know, we thought, well, there's some problems in South Africa, but we got our own problems, and, you know. But both of those were very striking.
Violent, and then got more violent, and then got more violent, and then it got ugly.
And then it got really ugly.
And then also you get the news from time to time that your cousin was killed, your mother died, your father, you know. So you just keep getting those news. I mean, my father went to every funeral every weekend, but he wrote me every week. So this week we buried so and so and so and so. Some people, of course, for natural causes, but most people, the government was killing.
It was striking to me to hear you talk about what you called correctly this radical social engineering. Because I sort of had, well, let's see, South Africa, all of Africa had been pretty well abused by colonialism for 350 years. But when apartheid started as an official policy, and was it 49, 48, 49?
48.
When these laws started in, it was, you made a really clear point in the sand that South Africa could have been with the world's great industrialized nations, and they made a point that they were going to go into this regressive, violent mode and defeated themselves in the process. But I really hadn't thought about how intentional this was and the grave consequences of making a profoundly bad decision. Mm.
Well, some of the effects that people are not aware of is that the Afrikaner people, you know, were the architects of apartheid, were themselves victims of conquest. You know, they fought the Anglo Boer War, and they were really treated like dogs by the British, you know, and they were put in concentration camps. And when they finally came out, they were poor white trash. And they could only get jobs as foremen in the mines, as bus drivers, as train drivers, they could get, like, they were heads in the unskilled labor market. And they were very bitter about it. And the British and the financial establishment felt this. And they said to themselves, well, we have made all our money. Let's give these people a chance. Let's take away the Indian voters' role and the native voters' role, which was keeping them out of power. And that way they'll be the white majority. But the deal that was made with them is that, listen, you can govern, but we can't give you anything else. So the only people they could take away, they could take from, was us. So they took our lands, they impoverished us, and when I left South Africa, the Afrikaners were basically still a poor society. But they just took and they grabbed from the neighboring countries as well, and to a certain extent disoriented as much as possible the neighboring countries which depended on them, and put their own governments in there that they felt were like their allies, and as a result they like really messed up all of Southern Africa. But another thing is that they were very, very bitter. That culturally also nobody recognized them, that they were, we looked at them as a bunch of like ignorant hillbillies, which is why in 1976, when they had power, they finally figured that everybody, they wanted to be like the French, you know, to say everybody, or the English, everybody must speak Afrikaans, must learn in Afrikaans. This has to be the culture of the country. And of course, that was their tragic flaw.
This is Hugh Masekela. Bill Russell and I, Paula Gordon, are delighted to be in his company. We'll all be back in a moment. Please be with us when we return.